5 decisions made in that four-month period, 228 were made with improper findings. That is, the counties failed in one way or another to apply the law properly. We then went a little bit further and looked at the decisions made in 5 Willamette Valley counties. We chose Clackamas, Yamhill, Polk, Marion, and Lynn. We chose them because they tend to be strong farm counties. They're all in the top 10 or 11 producers in the state, and they have a large number of decisions day to day, month to month. Those 5 counties in that four-month period approved 142 new residences or land divisions in that four-month period. Of the 142 decisions, we looked at all the findings. It was our determination that 133 of them were made with improper findings. We went beyond the findings, though, in those cases, and we looked at every single decision to see whether or not it was correct or incorrect in our judgment on the merits. And our finding was that 65% of the 142 decisions violated the criteria in this statute or the criteria in Goal 3. I want to read a couple of examples for you. In order to place a non-farm dwelling under the existing criteria, you have to meet 4 criteria. The 2 chief ones are you have to show that it's not going to interfere with farm practices on adjacent farms, and you have to show that the land is generally unsuitable for the production of farm crops and livestock. Lynn County approved a non-farm dwelling, file number CU-130. This is one of the decisions that was submitted to the Joint Committee. The Lynn County Board approved the non-farm residence on a 10.29-acre parcel. The Planning Department recommended denial. The Planning Commission recommended denial of the application because the parcel was good soil, Class 2 soil. There isn't much Class 2 soil in the state of Oregon. Was currently in wheat production and found that a non-farm residence on the site would interfere with the nearby commercial farm operation. The Lynn County Soil and Water Conservation District objected. Nevertheless, the County Board reversed the decision by the County Planning Commission and approved the dwelling and made improper findings. Marion County, file number 81-83, once again a non-farm dwelling. Same criteria apply. The County Hearings Officer approved a non-farm dwelling on a 6.25 acre parcel. The Planning Department had recommended denial on grounds that the parcel contained good soil, again Class 2 soil, was presently in agricultural production, and was being leased by an adjacent commercial farm. The hearings officer did not make adequate findings. I can go on, there are lots of examples. The point I'm making is that we have criteria in the statute, and we have a way of making the decisions. And yet, there is a steady, very steady intrusion of additional farm dwellings and non-farm dwellings into the Willamette Valley and exclusive farm zones. Not just on the bad land, it's on the good land too. There is a problem, and there's got to be a solution. Now, one of the possible solutions is to change the criteria. The EFU Task Force and the Joint Legislative Committee on Land Use make some recommendations about changing the criteria. I think those are good changes, and I support them. However, I don't think that's adequate. Another possible solution is to change procedurally the way those decisions are being made. I don't think, no matter what kind of criteria you put in the statute, county governing bodies are going to apply them in the way they were intended regularly. They are still going to misapply them. They are not the proper bodies to be making that decision, those decisions. Another possible way, another possible solution is to get away from criteria and get towards standards. The difference being a criterion says you deny if there's going to be serious interference, you approve if there's not going to be serious interference. A standard is something that is crisp and concrete and you can see it and you don't have to use much judgment. If the facts are there, you get the dwelling. If the facts are not there, you don't get the dwelling. I think that's the direction in which we ought to be moving, or to identify situations in which you don't want dwellings at all. So there's no discretion whatsoever, no opportunity to misinterpret a criterion or violate a standard. Let the law be crystal clear. In this kind of situation, you don't have farm dwellings. I think that what's in 237, the new criteria for non-farm dwellings, are a step in the right direction. They say on page 7, I believe, lines 12 and 13, a dwelling or activities associated with the dwelling will not force a major change in or measurably increase the cost of accepted farming practices on nearby lands devoted to farm use. The standard that's in the law now says will not seriously interfere. The problem with that standard is we don't know what serious means. I have another example here that comes out of Clackamas County, a proposal to divide a 5-acre piece of Class 2 land that's got some rural residences on one side and 40-acre parcels of cropland on the other side. The hearings officer says this is not going to seriously interfere because there are already some rural residences in the area. One more isn't going to be serious. That's the problem with the standard. Every time you review these things, you review them in isolation on a case-by-case basis. It never does. One more non-farm dwelling never does seem to be serious. But the ultimate effect is you keep approving them, and you have more and more rural residences and less farmland.
Mr. Chairman.
Dick, don't you have the same problems with words like major change or measurably increase the cost?
I'd like to see you take major out, but measurably at least gives you something, gives the farm operator in the county something to hold on to. If, in the Maryland Stringer case, if because of the location of a non-farm dwelling next to Maryland Stringer's cherry orchard, she's going to have to, her spray plane's going to have to come in from the east instead of the west and make 3 passes rather than 1 pass, that's going to cost her $150 more. That's measurable. If that's the kind of interference that's going to come from that residence, then that residence should not be approved in that location. I think it's a vast improvement over simply using the word seriously. I know you've got some other people to testify. I've proposed an amendment to Agriculture for Oregon's criterion for new farm dwellings on existing parcels. That's the language on page 6 between lines 4 and 9. The $20,000 in gross income and temporary dwelling, etc. The problem that my organization has with this language is it seems to suggest that if you've got a parcel that doesn't meet these standards, it's smaller than the average farm producing $20,000. It's smaller than 20 acres in any event. It seems to say, put a temporary dwelling on it without limitation. Go ahead, put the temporary dwelling unit on it. We think that's a mistake. It's going to encourage the siting of temporary dwellings. People are going to go ahead and put them out there, and they're not going to farm. What we would suggest in the language that I've submitted to you is that if a person does have a parcel that is not as large as the farm pieces producing $20,000 in gross income or more, that person has to submit a management plan that indicates that the land is suitable for and the person has a plan that will produce $20,000 in gross income when the plan is effective. Now you've heard a lot of criticism of the use of the $20,000 figure. In Yamhill County is very diverse, and it has cherries, and it has wheat, and so on and so forth, and they all require different sizes of parcels. And isn't the point, though, that what you're trying to accomplish here is you're trying to distinguish between a rural residence and someone who's trying to build a dwelling in conjunction with farm use? We've been looking at this problem ever since the agricultural lands goal was adopted in 1975. We've been unable to find any better way to distinguish between a farm operation and a country estate. The data is available from the Census Bureau right now that will tell you the person who's got cherries, the average field that's producing cherries, that's maybe all cherries, the farm may be all cherries, or if it's just a portion of a farm, the farmer has cherries and he has wheat. The Census Bureau data will tell you the size of the cherry farm or the cherry field that's part of a farm that produces $20,000 or more in gross income. And for cherries, that parcel size is going to be relatively small. For wheat, for grass, etc., the parcel is going to be relatively large. Well, don't you want that kind of variation? If somebody's coming forward and saying, I'm going to plant cherries on my 24-acre piece, or I'm going to plant wheat on my 24-acre piece, well, you know, right from the start, you can get figures about how much wheat can be produced per acre, what kind of income they're going to get for so many bushels of wheat. That's not going to be a farm. That's going to be a rural residence, and there's going to be some agricultural activity on the parcel, perhaps not. But I don't understand. I don't understand why the 20,000 gross income standard is inapplicable in counties that have diverse agriculture.
Mr. Chairman, one of my problems with it is that I don't see that it's any more an enforceable standard than existing law. I don't see what you're going to do if the strawberry farmer has a couple bad years. Is he going to go pull his mobile home out or?
That's absolutely right. That's an enforcement problem, and this doesn't deal with the enforcement problem. But at least if you have a criterion, which is different from the criteria we have today, in a lot of cases, you're not going to have that dwelling out there in the first place. You're not going to have the enforcement problem.
Well, what about the enforcement of the management plan that the person submits? He then later turns his place into a country estate. What enforcement options do you have now? Isn't there a fairly heavy tax penalty that goes for not maintaining the land as farmland? It's in current law later in the bill.
Yeah, a tax penalty is a very good idea. I think you'll find that enforcement of the tax provisions of 308 are very patchy, and I support the amendments to the tax law that are being proposed by Agriculture for Oregon, but I don't think in and of itself it's an adequate enforcement mechanism. I agree with you that someone can come in with a farm management plan that indicates that they're going to plant enough to produce $20,000 worth of gross income and not do it. However, if you have that requirement, at least they have to indicate that the parcel in which they want to locate the farm dwelling is of a size and has soil that is suitable for the type of crop or livestock they're proposing to raise. And it's going to eliminate a lot of the non-farm dwellings that are posing as farm dwellings.
Yeah, I suppose I'm looking at it from the standpoint, Mr. Chairman, that if we can't enforce a tax penalty now, if we can't do that, how are we ever going to enforce a provision that says, you know, we have to remove the dwelling? And that seems like a lot tougher to enforce. And again, my concern is that you end up with temporary dwellings and mobile homes scattered on farmland.
There is, of course, another solution. And that is, if someone's proposing to build a farm dwelling on a parcel that doesn't meet this standard, the answer is no. You cannot put the farm dwelling on a parcel that's too small for the kind of commercial agriculture that you're proposing to do. You get a lot more no answers that way.
So you then turn it into rural residential?
No. If somebody's got 17 acres and they're proposing to put corn on it, and the census data says that the average parcel in corn that's part of a farm producing $20,000 or more in gross income is 23 acres, and this person's only got 17, you tell that person you can't put a farm dwelling on that parcel.
So what happens to the parcel?
Well, the person has a parcel that can be sold to a farmer for farm use, or the person can raise corn on it and sell the corn. He just can't build a dwelling on it. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Genevieve Barham.
For the record, I'm Genevieve Barham from Route 1, Box 259B, Monroe in Benton County. I run beef cattle on 52 acres. Mr. Chairman and the committee members that are left here, I want to impose on the exceptions process myself because the calendar that I got stated that we would be talking about marginal lands today. So I prepared my testimony on that. I have a page and a half, which I'd like to read into the record.
Go right ahead.
Thinking I was adhering to the kinds of things that you wanted. I think I can proceed on the assumption that we all want to protect farmland. I want to protect it, and you want to protect it, and I'm sure the proponents of this bill want to. Our difference comes in our philosophy on the best means of protecting it. Very often, one who is in opposition to stringent land use regulations is labeled as wanting to do harm to farmland, and that just isn't true. And it's also used as a red herring to get their way on certain measures. Senate Bill 237, in my opinion, and in that of many others with whom I've spoken, does not save farmland for all farmers, only for those with big holdings. It is also vague in places and leaves much to be desired in others. Addressing the marginal land concept, at first glance, it seems that line 13, page 2, is at least recognizing small operators, and we could certainly agree with that. But the criterion of income is arbitrary and artificial. What of someone who has just planted an orchard and did not have income in the past or the given 5 years because his crop hadn't matured? Is that land to be called marginal? Or what of the large acreage that just had poor management in the last 5 years and didn't produce the given amount? Is that marginal too? What of an appendage to a large holding which, because of its shape or location or other reasons, is not profitable to the operator, but which would be productive in the hands of a farmer who doesn't mind bending his back and applying a little tender loving care? Allowing it to be used would increase real production and give the big operator additional cash for his operation. Our goal should be to really save farmland, not to see how much we can get into the hands of big operators. I wonder just how long our energy supply is going to support manufacturing and the running of the big machines that they use anyway. So the small operators to be recognized at last. Oh my, no. The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. A of 13 immediately takes back any glimmer of promise to the beginning or small operators. What is an area of 320 acres? Who decides where the boundary is? I wonder how it'll be gerrymandered around. It is highly unlikely that any 300-acre area as delineated here can be found anywhere in this state. I'm opposed to the concept of clustering for several reasons, one of which is that it often puts too much strain on a groundwater supply. Small and large farms interspersed make much more sense. Most farmers are friendly. Only a few object to having neighbors, and they're the vocal ones whose underlying motive is to buy cheaply the land that the small operator would like to farm. I'd like to interject here that probably there are more people from the towns where we intend to wall people up coming out and driving across alfalfa fields to fishing holes than there are of neighbors out there who do it. At least the hunters that come across my field are usually, shoot through the cattle, are usually from the towns, not from the rural areas. B of 13 says that only large operators may use fertile land, the 1-4 classification. Many operations which need fertile land might require only a small acreage. Imagine someone wanting to produce kiwi fruit. Now, I just did that, threw that in there because it wouldn't apply to anything we have here. But don't laugh. Remember that our neighboring states smiled or even scoffed at the raising of grapes in Oregon. Now, that industry's thriving. This bill is biased against small farms and does not allow for innovative operators. Of course, there are. You don't just necessarily need to provide for innovative operators because there are people at the moment who are presently farming who don't need large parcels of land, but they do need to live on that parcel. People who raise berries or vegetables, or how much land do you need to raise to have bees? And we do need honey as well as bread from the big wheat farms. We need to avoid regulations which prohibit freedom to, oh, I forgot to mention that hops was an industry, an agricultural industry, which came and went. There was a need to fill the vacancy there. I wish that Senator Cohen had been here because this I think, addresses the thing she was concerned about.
I wish that she was here also.
Probably for a different reason. This bill legislates out the innovator, the small operation, and the beginning farmer. It keeps the status quo of big grass seed farmers, and of course we do need them. I'm not advocating that they be hurt, but we also need to keep up innovations in our farm economy. You've heard expert testimony in these hearings that, excepting for rock piles, land underwater, and possibly sand dunes, no land in western Oregon is so non-productive as to meet the under 50 cubic feet per acre per year standard. So you see, there's no such thing as marginal land using 13A or 13B. The saying, thanks for nothing, is most apt here. Further, I'm opposed to the commission amending the goals, that's in section 3, without consulting the citizens of the state in a very extensive manner. That would be contrary to goal 1. It would be saying, we've allowed citizens to work for years, and now they think that things are getting settled, we'll slip around behind their backs and redo things to our liking. 4 of section 3, line 37 on page 3, is superfluous because there just wouldn't be such a thing as marginal land. We need to decide marginal on the basis of productivity or location or proximity to some big operator or ownership or size or some other whim. But you can't use all those, or marginal land simply fades away to a big zero. The concept as presented in this bill is biased, flawed, and counterproductive to the farming both present and future, and must not be foisted on our citizens. Please delete it from your thinking. I could respond to some of the other points that were made today, but I think since I thought the calendar stated that testimony was only to be on marginal land concept, I'm limiting my remarks to that. However, I'd like to continue my testimony on Friday and on the other agenda items of that day. Could I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Why was the lot of record not mentioned in the calendar?
Well, it is, we're dealing with land, I believe land divisions and
minor partitions.
Will it be at some future point?
Well, yeah, we're going to be able to, we're discussing that Friday to an extent. If you have something to say on it right now.
I just wanted to, I didn't want to prepare some testimony that you didn't want to listen to on Friday is the sort of reason I was asking. It didn't appear on my list.
I believe someone else, it doesn't specifically say lot of record.
Okay, so it would be permissible.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Matt and Carl?
Mr. Chairman, I, members of the committee, I think that you have a copy of what I have to present. It's rather an impassioned plea to keep our farm use laws and get them in a manner that that is our land use laws and get them in a manner to that they're workable and enforceable. I would like to say that I live in Marion County. I think Marion County has probably done as well or perhaps better than any other county in land use work. However, I'm might say some distance from being completely satisfied, and we keep centering around the if the present laws were really enforced, we would not have to make the changes. But the testimony that I have heard indicates to me that there has to be some changes so that the law is more definitive, because the planters from Clackamas County and from particularly some 2 weeks ago in this room, I think on another bill, when one of the senators asked a question why they didn't do a better job, well, the law wasn't definitive enough. We had a lot of leeway there and we used it. And I think that is the crux, perhaps, of our problem. And think rather than to forego, I noticed the chairman looking at the clock. I'm not sure how long you want to run here, so.
Oh, no, I just don't mind me. I apologize for looking. I'm supposed to be chairing another subcommittee at 7, and I've sent someone down to tell them I could. I'm going to try a little bit too. I would like to get everyone in today. But to those of you who signed up fairly late in the hearing, I am going to take the people that signed up earlier first. So, and if we don't get it, everyone will certainly let you put you on first on Friday.
It appears to me that most people see the desirability of planning and zoning for cities, but many feel that the area outside of city limits is open country, where each individual owner should be able to do whatever he chooses. Some new owner developers, as well as long-term farm and forest landowners, want to participate in the divide-and-destroy process. Each farm and forest is a food or fiber factory. It is a water-storing, pollutant-absorbent, solar-heated, renewable resource base, providing far more property tax than it demands for public service. Every good farm has been developed with a conservation that continues ever-increasing productivity as a fundamental objective. We need more protection, or more effective protection, for preserving our farm and forest resources. I believe that the most productive land should have first priority for agricultural use, because for all other uses, the productive capacity, the main source of our state's wealth, is destroyed forever. The less productive land should not be committed and destroyed unnecessarily or prematurely. Some mistakes in planning are irreversible, such as paving over productive land. The property rights issue concerning land use planning is misrepresented, misconstrued, and misused. Each of us, as individuals and as part of the general public, have individual and collective rights. We also have responsibilities. We have property rights consistent with the zones we are in and the responsibility to maintain the integrity of the zone. If the zoning is improper, we must work toward changing the zone. We need continuity, updating, education, and improving in our planning process. Each owner in zone must have the same opportunity for use of his property. Length of time of ownership should have no bearing on what rights a property owner has. The exceptions process should be limited and used sparingly, as it gives the one owner privileges not extended to all others. Exceptions often cause conflicts and are the loopholes that can cause the loss of effectiveness of the zone and also reduce the resource base in an EFU zone, or EFU or forest zone. Non-farm homes are a major source of conflict in EFU zones. Commercial livestock farming and residential zone would likewise cause considerable conflict of interest. Many farms, including my own, have several classes of land. My farm is typical of the Willamette Valley and has seven different land classifications, all interspersed. Allowing non-farm residences interspersed throughout the farm would involve the need to destroy several acres of the best land to provide roads to the less productive land. I think there's a second page there that I'll let you leave at the leisure. However, the most important factor is that non-farm residents themselves are in conflict with agricultural activities. And to work out these workable exceptions, the gentleman that workable exceptions. I remember a testimony by the homeowners association at one time claiming that they, in effect, were farmers because they grew homes. And to some people, this has logic. To me, it has none at all, because it destroys the resource base that we have. And the exceptions process is the method by which, inadvertently or deliberately, they continue to destroy our land use base. The homestead provision, as one county or two, I think, said that they think is a good provision. I think one of the senators mentioned the fact that on a continuing basis, this would soon destroy, new homestead. It's like some of the provisions that we've had at one time where you could put a piece of land to each one of your children. Well, I was on the Land Use Planning Commission for 7 years. Two of the members of that commission had eight children apiece, and I had five, and some of them had small acreage as well. It wouldn't take long until they'd have their own community, of course. And this points up, and I would like to excuse them enough to get my map. I think one of the things to continue to look at, I don't know. This map showing how little land in the state of Oregon is truly agricultural land that we're trying to preserve. The Willamette Valley there is relatively small, and there are areas in California, larger
probably than that, the Livermore Valley, the Santa Clara Valley are totally covered already. And perhaps we have to use a little persuasion, but the thing that we have found is that the farmers, at least in my area, they were against land use planning to start with. They wanted to do as they pleased. By God, we've always done it, it's gonna be all right. They've totally changed their mind in the last few years because they've seen that their neighbor did as he pleased, and so he put up a trailer court. And I've got two of them within 2 miles of my place. This is a map of an area between Hubbard and Woodford, Hubbard and Aurora. This was a nice farm 10 years ago. There's 72 lots, and this is only part of it. There's more lots over here. A good farm, and this was put in on number one and two land is type of area that predominates in the area in which I live. And that's, of course, one of the reasons we brought land use planning in effect. Some people say, well, we believe in it, but we've